All right, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Zechariah, chapter 8. It's where we left off. It's a little lengthier chapter than what we've been reading the last few nights. But it's not as difficult reading, I think, as what we went through the first five or six chapters. And I think there's still there's quite a message, I think, for all of us in what we read tonight, in terms of a lot of times God in the circumstances and the situations that we have to deal with in life, where we find ourselves in life, it can be very easy, I think, to look at our experiences and feel like, you know, that God is not involved, or he doesn't care, or that he's indifferent, or that he's unconcerned. To me, that's the worst thing to have to experience. I think that if you look at the life of Job, for example, you look at what happened to Job. Obviously, he lost all of his possessions, and he lost all of his children. Then he lost his health. And then his wife turned on him, and his servants turned on him. He found himself in a dump heap, scraping boils off of his body. And and even his friends turned against him, you know. But in all of that situation, the thing that tormented him the most, the thing that just drove him to despair, was God's silence. That, more than anything else, I mean, it was like he could take everything but God's apparent indifference. Okay? He said, man, I look to the right, I can't find him. Look behind me, I can't find him. Look up, I look all, I search for him, and I can't find him. If I could just find him, I would plead my case before him. I would, you know, talk to him as a man talks to a man, as a, you know, I would just, if I could just get a hold of him. Now, I think that we've all been there, right? I mean, in situations where in life we feel like, well, where is God? I mean, is he concerned? Does he care? Does he really give a hoot? I mean, if you feel that reassurance that through difficulties and trials and heartbreaks and setbacks, disappointments and everything else you have to contend with, if you have that confidence that, hey, God cares and he's in control and he's got a plan, it gives you hope. But if you feel like, you know, you got no hope, I mean, then it's what's left but despair. I mean, that's the thing that just drove Job to total despair, where he just cursed the day of his birth. And I think a lot of us have been there. I know I've been there time again, where you just wish that you'd never been born, because the most difficult thing to bear is that, you know, wonder well, where is God in this situation? You know, does he really give a rat's behind, you know? Does he really care? Because he sure seems silent, and his silence can only be interpreted as being indifference. Well, we have to always keep in mind that God's thoughts are our thoughts, his ways are our ways. And he says, my thoughts are higher than the heavens are high, and my ways are different from yours as far as the heavens are high. In other words, you know, if we look out to the heavens, there's absolutely no end to it. Scientists, astronomers, and everybody else cannot find an end to, you know, this universe. So, I mean, that's how infinitely beyond our thoughts God's thoughts are, and his ways are infinitely beyond ours. And that's where our faith comes in. And I was in church today just struggling with that very concept of this, you know, feeling like sometimes God is so overwhelming. I mean, you ever feel that way, that he's just so overwhelming, that he's incomprehensible and he's just untouchable in terms of, you know, do you really care? Do you really, can you really feel this struggle, this pain, this heartbreak, you know? And if you do, why do you seem so sublimely indifferent? I mean, that's the tough thing to deal with, isn't it? But the bottom line is, hey, you got to say, okay, my faith tells me, my experience, my feelings are telling me one thing, but my faith says to me, okay, I got to trust God. Like Job said, though he slay me, I will trust him. You got to make up your mind and say, okay, my faith, my trust in God tells me that God is too good to be unkind, and he's too wise to make mistakes. So, you know, when you look at things from that perspective, you know, I think it really can help us through some of the most difficult times or black moments when you feel like there's no way out, the whole situation seems hopeless. That's the time when I think you need to really grab on to God, grab on to to the end of the tether, to the end of the rope, and just tie a knot and say, okay, I'm going to continue to trust God. I'm not going to despair. I'm not going to let the devil get the best of me and drive me, you know, to the point where I just give up or capitulate or, you know, basically deny him. He said, okay, beginning with verse 1 in chapter 8 of Zechariah, says, then the word of the Lord of hosts came, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am exceedingly jealous for Zion. Yes, with great wrath I am jealous for her. Thus saith the Lord, I will return to Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Then Jerusalem will be called the City of Truth, and the mountain of the Lord of hosts will be called the mountain, the Holy Mountain. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, old men and old women will again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each man with his staff and in his hand because of age. And the streets of the city will be filled with boys and girls playing in the streets. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, is it too difficult in the sight of the remnant of this people in those days? Will it also be too difficult in my sight, declares the Lord of hosts? Now here's what I'm talking about in terms of you put yourself in a situation when Zechariah prophesied this. Zechariah prophesied at a time when the people, when a very small remnant of the people who had been dispersed into exile because of their sins, had now, after 70 years, come back to their beloved Jerusalem. They've come back to try to rebuild their lives, and then trying to rebuild their lives in the midst of economic difficulties, of political oppression, of difficulty with the Samaritans and their enemies, and threats from within and without, and struggles on every side. And I'm sure that many of them at that particular time thought, well, you know, where is God in this situation? Does he really care? Are we really going to get anywhere? I mean, we've seemed to have been reduced as a nation and as a people to virtually nothing. And is there any hope for us in the future as far as, you know, us as a nation are concerned? Well, when God speaks through Zechariah, look at basically what he says. The word of the Lord of hosts came, saying. Now, notice the number of times it mentions the Lord of hosts. Okay, I mentioned this before because God emphasizes it again and again and again in this chapter alone, referring to himself as the Lord of hosts. There is no one higher, there is no one greater. And when you say he's the Lord of hosts, it's just not a host of angels, but it's the host of everything. I think of everything that he's created. I don't care if it's a host of stars. I don't care if it's a host of fish, of birds, of fowl, of animals, of men, of angels, of devils. I mean, he is above everyone, everything. It's like he's the one that's talking to us. He's communicating to us through his prophets, saying, okay, you know, I want to reassure you, okay, there's no higher authority than myself and no surer authority than my word. I want to assure you that what? I am exceedingly jealous for you. I'm jealous for Jerusalem. I'm jealous for Zion. What does Zion stand for? Anybody remember?
The people of God.
Yeah. Zion stands for God's people, the people of God. Now, here we are gathered as part of Zion in that respect, that we are God's people. Now, I'm sure that many of us in this room are struggling and are hurting in one way, shape, or form or another, right? And we go through that struggle wondering, well, does God care? Is he concerned? Is he involved? Well, when he assures us through the prophet Zechariah, he says this. Okay, the word of the Lord of hosts came saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Twice he says it. I am exceedingly jealous. He's not just jealous. He's exceedingly jealous. I mean, you can bank on it. For him to be jealous means that he is watching over with intense concern and involvement. Okay? He's not indifferent. Not in the least bit. Okay? Because I think we've all experienced that emotion of jealousy, to know that it's something that is not it's anything but indifference. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said something to the effect that one of the greatest things that we can do to our fellow man is not to hate them, but to be indifferent towards them. Well, we all know that the emotion of jealousy is anything but indifferent. It is very, very much concerned and involved with the object of our affections or our love. Okay? And that's what God is saying here. I am exceedingly jealous. And so it seems sometimes it's reassuring to know in the midst of heartbreak or disappointment or pain that he's involved, that he is there, that he is concerned. But the problem is his thoughts aren't our thoughts, his ways aren't our ways. You know, in order to work something out for his glory, for his honor, and for our well-being and in the end, our ultimate perfection and happiness, he sees that we need to go through this. Like it says in the book of Hebrews, you know, that, you know, God disciplines every child that he, or every son that he accepts. And without discipline of God, that, you know, we are illegitimate children. So it basically tells us in the book of Hebrews to strengthen the hands that are feeble and the knees that are out of joint, and really resolve that, okay, even though my experience and my feelings are telling me one thing, I've got to trust God, okay, and walk by faith. That's the only way we're going to grow in our faith, isn't it? There's no possible way that we're going to be able to grow in the love and knowledge of God in our faith if we have nothing in life that gives us these difficult moments to where we need to trust Him. If everything goes our way and everything goes smooth, I mean, what need do we have of God, right? So it's these very things that we find so, I think, so difficult to deal with are the very things that we need the most. And so this is what's happening to Jerusalem as a whole, and God wants to assure them that, look, I'm exceedingly jealous for you. You know, you can bank on it, because I'm the Lord of hosts, and my word, okay, is the absolute authority, and I cannot lie, and I will not lie, and I will not deceive. Just trust me. So he says in verse 3, thus saith the Lord, I will return to Zion, and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Then Jerusalem will be called the city of truth. The mountain of the Lord of hosts will be called the holy mountain. Now, this is kind of interesting to me. He says in that verse 3 that I will return to Zion. I will return to God. So in other words, in order to return, you have had to have left, right? Okay, Christ came down as a babe in Jerusalem. He dwelt among his people in Jerusalem and in Israel, right? And then he left. But he promised his disciples when he was ascending into heaven that he would return. The angels, as the apostles watched Jesus ascend into heaven, the angels said, "You men of Galilee, why are you standing there looking up? The same Jesus who you've seen disappear in the clouds will return in like manner." Okay, then Jesus has promised that he will return. And there's so many promises throughout the scriptures that talks about his return. There's over 1,000 references to the second coming of Christ in the Old Testament, over 325 references to his second coming in the New Testament. We can bank on the fact that he's going to return. And when he returns, he says this, thus saith the Lord, I will return to Zion, to his people, and I will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Well, obviously, this is future date, but it goes right along with what all the prophets have foretold, what Jesus had predicted and everything else, that he will return and he will rule and reign on this earth and he will set things right. He's going to rule and reign from Jerusalem. And this is a prophecy that Zechariah is making centuries before Christ is even born. He says, then Jerusalem will be called the city of truth. Well, it's not called the city of truth now, is it? As a matter of fact, when we read in the book of Revelation and we read in other portions of Scripture, Jerusalem has been referred to as Sodom, as Egypt, as a violent city, as a harlot, as a, you know, I mean, there's just a whole list of names that Jerusalem has been called. Okay, she's been anything but what? Called the city of truth. But when Christ comes back, sets up his millennial kingdom, it'll be called the city of truth. Jesus himself said, I am the truth. I am the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. Well, this is where truth is going to dwell. Look at where we got. Look at the situation we've gotten just in this country alone. I'm not talking about the rest of the world, but just look at it. We've got people that are running this country, okay? The highest echelons of our government, right in the White House. I mean, can you get the truth out of these guys? I mean, you're trying to nail, it's like trying to nail a poached egg to a wall to get them to tell the truth. I don't remember. I don't recall. I don't, you know, it's like they know the truth, but they're not going to tell the truth. You know, everything that comes out of their mouth is a virtual lie, a virtual deception. The only time that they're going to tell the truth is when it's expedient. There's no question about it. You see this in our leadership today. You see it all over the turf. You see it from the White House down to the doghouse. Okay, the truth is trampled under the foot to the point where, you know, where have we come to? We've come where good is called evil and evil is called good, where truth is called a lie and a lie is called the truth. There's no question about it. People want to believe a lie, and this is why that God is going to allow this Antichrist and saint to have such control in the last days, because we are told in Thessalonians, because people would not believe the love of the truth, so as to be saved, God is going to allow them a strong deception. People want to believe a lie, because it's what they want to hear. Okay? I was just reading in a chronicle today where it says that Billy Graham is going to, you know, hold some crusades down in the Bay Area. And I guess they were interviewing him, and somebody asked a question. He's down there in San Francisco, and he says, well, what do you think of homosexuality? And Billy Graham says, well, homosexuality is a sin, and its lifestyle is condemned in the Bible. And then Billy Graham also emphasized the fact, he said, but, you know, homosexuality isn't any different sin than, you know, all these other sins that we have to contend with. I don't care whether it's fornication or adultery or all these other things. And right away, now, especially down on that hotbed of sin, people are condemning him. And there's people, I read there that they got this metropolitan church down there that caters to the whole gay community. And they're saying, well, we're not going to attend his crusade, right? Well, here's the thing, okay? Now, either it's a sin or it's not, okay? But people want to deceive themselves into believing, well, this is not a sin. And for you to say it's a sin, that's a sin. Okay? This is where we've come to. In other words, when it comes to truth. Okay? I think that God, I certainly would have much more respect for people who say, hey, yeah, this is a sin, and I love my sin, and this is the lifestyle I want. And Jesus Christ and all the rest of you can just go fly a kite. Hey, I can salute that. But see, we have this mindset that we want to be told in terms that says, hey, it's not a sin. So we want to be told a lie, see? We don't want to be told the truth, right? This is where we are at as a nation. Don't tell me the truth, because I don't want to hear it. So we plug our ears and say, tell me a lie. When Jesus Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom, Jerusalem is going to refer to as the city of truth. Okay? There's not going to be any of this, you know, waltzing around the truth and forever telling half-truth and lies and saying, oh, I can't remember, I don't recall. And, you know, it's just going to be a totally different situation. Well, it says it's going to be called the City of Truth, and the mountain of the Lord of Hosts will be called the Holy Mountain. Okay, that Jerusalem is seated on Mount Moriah, or seated on a mountain that is going to be referred to as a holy mountain. That's when Christ comes and rules and reigns. Obviously, this has never been the case in the past, and it certainly isn't the case in the present, right? But here again, we've got another promise coming from God that he will rule and reign outside of Jerusalem, and he will rule and reign in justice and in truth, and it'll be a time of peace and prosperity, a time when the devil will be bound for 1,000 years. And look what he describes the way it's going to be. Look at verse 4. It says, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Again, he uses that term, right? 3 times we've read it so far. Okay. Old men and old women will again be in the streets of Jerusalem, each man with his staff and his hand because of age. Now, here's an interesting thing. Like I said, in Zechariah's time, it seemed like they had no future. They were going nowhere fast. Okay. But God is assuring them that there will become a time when the streets of Jerusalem will be filled with old men and old women. Well, what he's describing here is a situation where people will live to old age. I mean, we were told in Isaiah, basically tells us that during the millennial period that people will live to be as old as trees or older. Okay, now there will still be death in the millennial period. I mean, people will die, let's say, of old age, but they will live like they did in the days of Noah or before the days of flood. You know, people will live literally hundreds of years old, because it'll be a situation where the whole ecology of the world will be transformed by Christ when he sets up his millennial kingdom. And like I said, there will be still be sin in the world, and there'll still be death in the world, because the people who are living in the millennial period will still have a fallen nature. But things will be so transformed, okay, that everything will be conducive to longevity as far as life and happiness and fulfillment. You know, everything is going to go in that direction. And when he says here in that verse 4 and 5, he's talking about that old men and old women will again sit in the streets of Jerusalem, each man with his staff in his hand because of age, and the streets will be filled with and the city will be filled with boys and girls playing in the streets. So he's describing a situation where there's going to be peace, there's going to be prosperity, there's going to be tranquility, there's going to be love, there's going to be joy, there's going to be happiness. Okay, it's going to be a time when he's ruling and reigning, and this is what it's going to be like. He says in verse 6, thus saith the Lord of hosts, Is it too difficult in the sight of the remnant of this people in those days? Will it also be too difficult in my sight, declares the Lord of hosts? So here's something we've got to keep in mind, okay? Like I said, whatever difficulties you may be going through in life, it may seem like, well, God doesn't care, he's indifferent, okay? Well, he's asking the question, is that too difficult for the sight of the remnant of this people? The remnant of the people, they thought, hey, we got no future. Man, it's in the toilet. Forget it. But he's saying, hey, is it too difficult? He basically asks Abraham the same question. Is anything too hard to God as far as, you know, Sarah was way beyond bearing child age, right? I mean, her womb was dried up, and Abraham was an old man, and the whole thing looked ridiculously hopeless. But that's where God wanted to get him. And then get in a situation where, you know, it was beyond the realm of human ingenuity to accomplish anything of their own, so that God could get total glory. And it's interesting how God answered Abraham's prayer and Sarah's prayer, basically, when they did give the child, when she did give birth to a child in her old age. They called him what?
Laughter.
Isaac, which means laughter. And can you imagine if there's a 100-year-old lady that gives a birth, okay, after being childless, wanting a child, you know, a 90-year-old lady, a 100-year-old lady. I mean, they called him Isaac because everybody would see this baby and they'd laugh because of it was so incredulous. It was so impossible. And people could do nothing but laugh. They called him laughter. They called him Isaac. You see, that's where sometimes God wants to get us in a position in our life where it's so impossible, it's beyond any human ability to accomplish, you know, our heart's desire or what we want. And then when you get to that point, then you really have to rely upon God and not our own scheming, our ingenuity, and our pushing and our shoving and our trying, and just rest in Him and let Him carry it. And then He gets the glory, and He works it out for our good. So that's when He asks in that verse 6, is it too difficult in the sight of the remnant of His people in those days? Will it also be too difficult in my sight, declares the Lord? Nothing's too difficult for Him. He do anything He wants. And verse 7, it says, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Again, he uses that title. And I stress that because he stresses it. How many times have we read it? Just in these 5, 6, 7 verses. Again, he's referring to himself as the Lord of hosts, emphasizing, hey, this is me talking. Okay? This is not somebody in the White House talking. But this is God talking, right? The Lord of hosts. Right? He says, hey, I will bring them, verse 7 says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I am going to save my people from the land of the east and from the land of the west. Now, here's an interesting thing. God was talking about, you know, earlier on, when we were going through a lot of the symbolism that Zechariah was talking about, he talked about dealing with the land of the north, right? Basically, dealing with the land of the north. And as a matter of fact, when he sent out the chariots, remember when we went through that chapter when I drew those diagrams of the various chariots, when one was going to the north and the other one was going to the south? Well, he was talking about the land from the east and the west. Well, I don't know if you can see it on the map there. Well, you can see it on the lower part. What's west of Jerusalem? It's the Mediterranean Sea. Okay, and of course, east of Jerusalem, you find Babylon. It's a little northeast, but it's basically east of Jerusalem. So when he's talking about east and west, I believe this is a far-reaching prophecy in terms of the latter days, when we are told that from the east there will come, you know, an army of 200 million men, the kings of the east. They will converge on Jerusalem along with all the millions that will come from the western world, and they will come there and converge in the valley of Megiddo or Armageddon for the last battle of the world, and that's where Christ will come back and deal a death-dealing blow to all of his enemies and the enemies of his people. So I believe this is what it's referring to in its ultimate culmination or its ultimate fulfillment is the land of the east and the land of the west. In other words, when all the nations of the world are going to converge from east and west on Jerusalem, on Israel, for the last battle, and that's where God is going to judge the nations. That's what he says. And he says this through so many of the prophets, like, for example, Joel described how multitudes in the valley decisions, how God is going to bring all of these nations together for, you know, what he calls the great wine press that John describes in the book of Revelation, where he's going to, you know, annihilate his enemies there and the enemies of his people. He will stand up, and in that day, when he stands up, you will see not only the fury of God and the anger of God, but you will see the jealousy of God for his people. And so he says in that Well, that verse 8 says, and I will bring them back, and they will live in the midst of Jerusalem, and they will be my people, and I will be their God in truth and righteousness. Now, when Christ comes back, he's going to dwell in Jerusalem. But look what he's saying, kind of interesting, okay? He says, I will bring them back, which they already are back now. They got back in the land back in, well, it was 1918. They had that Balfour Treaty that made the designated Palestine as a national homeland for the Jews. In 1948, it became a nation again, right? Well, the people are coming back, and they're back now. But Jesus Christ is not their God, is he? Read this, verse 8. And I will bring them back, and they will live in the midst of Jerusalem, which they are now, and they will be my people, and I will be their God in truth and righteousness. Well, he's not their God now. Okay? He is for some of the Jews, for a remnant of the Jews, but for the majority of the Jews, Jesus Christ is still rejected. But we are told later on in the book of Zechariah that when they see him return, whom they have pierced, they will mourn for him as for an only son who died. I mean, they will really be beating their breath and recognize their sin and how they have really blown it by rejecting their Messiah. But then he's going to set up his millennial kingdom, and they're going to recognize him as being not only their Savior, their Messiah, but also their God, who was God in truth and in righteousness. And this is what God looks for. Remember when the Samaritan woman asked Jesus to, you know, whether the Jews were right in worshiping Jerusalem or whether the Samaritans were right in worshiping on Mount Gerizim. And Jesus said, hey, you know, there's coming a day when God will look for those who worship him in spirit and in truth. And that's what God looks for. Okay? Is spirit and in truth. That's and spirit and in righteousness, or truth and righteousness. It all goes along with hand in hand. A time when, you know, there'll be truth will be reigning and righteousness will be reigning. It won't be this deceptiveness. It won't be this deceit. There won't be these cults. There won't be these false religions and these, you know, all of these different things. Christ will be reigning with truth and righteousness. And I think in Isaiah it talked about how there'll come a day when the knowledge of God will fill the earth as the waters fill the sea. And it says in verse 9, it says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, let your hands be strong, you who are listening in these days. To these words from the mouth of the prophets, those who spoke in the day that the foundations of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid to the end of the temple that might be built. Okay, this is verse 9. Okay, I think it, again, is speaking to us in terms of sometimes when we feel like, hey, there's no hope, there's no future. Okay, what's the point? Does God really care? Is he really concerned? Well, he's giving us an admonition here. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. Again, he uses that phrase. Let your hands be strong, you who are listening in these days to these words from the mouth of the prophets, those who spoke in the day that the foundations of the house of the, house of the Lord of hosts was laid to the end of the, to the end that the temple might be built. In other words, those two prophets were Haggai and Zechariah, who were prophesying during the time that the foundation was laid. This is what he's talking about. Listen to these prophets, because these prophets are giving hope. They are predicting what your future is going to be, and it's going to be a glorious future. But he says, let your hands be strong. And sometimes we have to do that. Sometimes, you know, when we just feel like we are so low that we just can't get any lower in our life, okay? Sometimes we really just have to pray for the good grace that we desperately need to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps and with a cold, naked, intended will just say, okay, I'm going to trust God, and I'm going to continue to follow God. I'm going to continue to serve God and obey God, regardless of what my experiences might be and regardless of what my feelings might be. You have to make your hands be strong. In other words, that's something we have to do. Now, obviously, we can't do it apart from God's grace, but we have to determine that we're going to do it. I don't know how many people I've seen, and I've been a Christian, next month will be 25 years, over the past 25 years, I don't know how many people I've seen come and go who, when they run into trials, and they run into difficulties, they run into heartbreak and disillusionment, they give up. They capitulate. They run out of gas, they just don't have enough to wherewithal, and they go back to the world, they go back to their old ways, and of course they make things 10 times worse than they ever were, simply because they don't submit themselves to God's discipline, okay, and His guidance and His direction, and so forth, okay? So when we read this, I think this, that there's that admonition, let your hand be strong. In other words, you have to decide, okay, I'm going to do it. Whether I feel like it or not, I'm going to keep going. And that's tough. That is tough. Sometimes you just get overwhelmed emotionally. Sometimes you just get so down, spiritually, mentally. I mean, you know, that's just calling ace a spade a spade. I know that sometimes you go to these churches and you listen to these evangelists, you listen to these ministers, you know, it's like they flip a coin. Oh, praise God. I mean, everything's going to work out. And I say, well, where's this guy come from? You know, does he live in the same world I do? Sometimes you wonder about these people. You know, they got this health, wealth, and prosperity kick as though, you know, you're never going to have any trials. You're never going to have any problems. You're never going to have any, you know, setbacks or difficulties, you know, if you just keep, you know, have enough faith and just keep throwing the money my way. There's a lack of faith. You know, if you are in a wheelchair, it's because of lack of faith. Okay, if you are poverty stricken, it's because of lack of faith. That's all a bunch of baloney. Okay, and sometimes we just have to just recognize that no, God in His infinite wisdom can see that what we need most and what we need, you know, is best for us the way He deals with it. And you know, we have to just say, okay, I got to let my hands be strong. I've got to determine that. In spite of my feelings, in spite of the difficulties, I'm going to determine that I'm going to hang in there. Okay, and that's basically what he's telling these people to do, that to believe the prophets. Okay, and that's what we're doing here tonight, right? We're reading God's word. In other words, we're trying to say, okay, in spite of my feelings, I'm going to, you know, trust God and believe what he has told us through his prophets. And then in verse 10, he says, for before those days there was no wage for man or any wage for animal, and for him who went out or came in, there was no peace because of his enemies, and I set all men against one another. But now I will not treat the remnant of his people as in former days, declares the Lord of hosts. Now what he's talking about here, if you couple it with what we just read in verse 8, when he's talking about, let your hands be strong, you who are listening in these days, to these words from the mouth of the prophets, those prophets who spoke in the day that the foundation of the house of the Lord of hosts was laid, and to the end that the temple might be built. So in other words, basically what he's saying is this. He's saying, before my prophets told you to get your act together and start building, rebuilding this temple, remember what happened? They came back from Babylon. They laid the foundation of the temple. They were all enthused to do it. But then they ran into opposition. They ran into trouble. They ran into problems. And so they said, well, the heck with this. It's not time to do, you know, to build the temple. So they all went diddy-bopping off their own way and started paneling their own houses and doing their own thing, totally neglecting God and the things of God and the worship of God, feeling like, well, you know, if it was God's will, it wouldn't be so darn hard. Well, God had to send in some prophets. He sent them Zechariah and he sent them Haggai. And he said, hey, man, consider your ways. He says, man, you sow much, but you reap little. He says, it's like you put money in your pockets with holes in them, or your purses with holes in them. In other words, God was, you know, the things that people would work for, the material things and the money and everything, he would blow it away. Why? Because they didn't have their priorities right. And when they didn't have their priorities right, look at what he describes here. And it doesn't just describe our nation. To me, it certainly does. Our nation does not have its priorities right. That's obvious, okay? And as a result, look what happens. In verse 10, for before those days, there was no wage for man or wage for animal. In other words, before they got their priorities right, they were struggling economically. They were really in dire straits. There was no wage for man or for animal. In other words, they could hardly feed themselves, let alone their animals. That's how difficult they couldn't, you know. And let's face it, today, it's we're getting a situation where the rich are definitely getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, the middle class is going into debt fast, okay? And the middle class is basically, we're lucky if we can live from paycheck to paycheck. Hard to keep our ears above water, right? Well, that's the way it was then when he didn't have the priorities right, okay? So he's talking about there's no wage for man or for animal. And for him who went out or came in, there was no peace. That's this world today. That's this country today. Inside and out. There's no peace. When he went in, when he would go home, there's no peace. And we know today the most violent place in the world is the American home. It's just astounding the record numbers of children killing their parents, parents killing their children, spouses killing each other, right? No peace when you go in, no peace when you go out. Look at our streets, which are becoming nothing more than a war zone, right? Because we got our priorities all messed up. He says, him who went out or came in, there was no peace because of his enemies, and I set all men against one another. God said, he sent all men against one another. Look at this nation. Are we a divided nation? You mean the real ignoramuses, as far as I'm concerned, among us, are saying, well, our diversities are our strength. And I say, well, why don't you get your head out of the hole? Our diversities have become our undoing. Why? Because we do not have our priorities right. And so God is setting all men against one another. And so today we see more than ever, okay, blacks against whites, men against women, corporations against workers, unions against corporations, politicians against each other. I mean, it just goes all over the turf, isn't there? There is strife. There is contention. There is division. There is animosity. There is hatred. There is just incredible division, isn't there? Because we don't have our priorities right. And then he says in verse 11, it says, but now I will not treat the remnant of this people as in former days, declares the Lord of hosts. Okay, he says now. Now that these people have gotten their temple rebuilt, now that they're getting their priorities right, he's going to begin to bless them. That's basically what he's saying. He says in verse 12, for there will be peace for the seed, the vine will yield its fruit, and the land will yield its produce, and the heavens will give their due, and I will cause the remnant of this people to inherit all these things. So now he's basically saying, now that these people are getting their priorities right, they're getting the temple built, they're putting their worship where it belongs, now he's going to begin to bless them economically, and in their families, and in their streets, and in their politics, and everything else. Okay, that's the way God does. Again and again and again, you will read almost 700 promises in his word, always says, if you do this, I'll do that. If you do that, I'll do this. I mean, everything is basically conditional. And so that's basically what he's telling them here. And it's only a forerunner of what's going to be culminated when Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom. Okay, the peace and the prosperity that will be the result of people living in righteousness and truth when he's ruling and reigning. And then he says here in that verse 13, and it will come about that just as you were a curse among the nations, O house of Judah and house of Israel, so I will save you that you may become a blessing. Do not fear, let your hands be strong. Okay, again, we see God's economy and the way things have worked. Okay, if he says, if you do all these things, this is all the blessings that you will receive. If you do all these other things, these are the curses that will come upon you. Well, they ended up being a curse and a byword among the nations. But he's saying, if you reverse that, then as a result, you become a blessing. But he says this again in verse 13. Again, for emphasis, what does he say? Do not fear, let your hands be strong. Again, I think that's a real strong commission to us, that in spite of our experiences, in spite of our feelings, okay, in spite of what we may sense, we've got to say, okay, I've got to live by faith. The righteous will live by faith, right? And to just trust God and let your hands be strong and do the right thing. Not to capitulate, not to give up, not to backslide, not to let up. Then he says in the verse 14, for thus saith the Lord of hosts, just as I propose to do harm to you when your fathers provoked me to wrath, says the Lord of hosts, I have not relented, so I have again proposed in these days to do good to Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Do not fear. Again, he tells them, do not fear a second time. But he, again, what does he say? Just as he had proposed to bring upon a curse to the disobedient fathers, okay, now he's proposed that he's going to bring upon a blessing to those who obey him. This is God. He doesn't change. We are told that. He's the same yesterday, the same today, he's the same tomorrow. I mean, to me, that can be very assuring. It also can be very frightening, right? Okay, we may try, and like we were just talking about earlier, how many people today, they will lie to themselves because they want to live a particular lifestyle. You know, we think that, well, we want to bring God down and make him into our own image in terms of something that's more livable, something we can feel comfortable with. Okay, we view him not as an all-consuming fire who says, hey, you know, you better obey me. Okay, but we like to look at him as kind of like a cuddly mascot, some kind of celestial butler or Santa Claus, who we could feel comfortable with, right, and just get what we want out of him. But we don't want him to make any demands upon us and to tell us that, hey, our lifestyles and our abomination are going to throw us into eternal damnation and separation from him, because we don't want to hear that. But he's telling these people, look, rest assured, Just as I brought curses upon those who didn't obey me, I will bring upon blessings upon you who do. And it says in verse 16, these are the things that you should do. Speak the truth to one another. Judge with truth and judgment for peace in your gates. Okay, here again, This is the things that God tells us to do, all right? We always come up with these cockamamie ideas of what to do for God, but this is what God basically wants us to do, just like he said in Micah. What does the Lord require you, O Israel, but to do justice, love, mercy, walk humbly with the Lord your God? Well, look what he says in verse 16. These are the things you should do. Speak the truth to one another. Okay? I mean, let's face it. We look at our society, we look at our nation, and how many people really speaking the truth to one another? I mean, I get so much junk mail. I don't know how many people get junk mail, but you get it in the mail all the time. You have just won an automobile. You have just won this. You have just won that. And it's all a con. And you get the stuff in the mail, right? Mm-hmm. Or I like the way they word it, like, you know, the sweepstakes. They come in. This is presented to John, who has just won $1 million. But then you read the fine print. If you send in the right number, this is what it would say. You know what I'm saying? It's all deception. It's all phony.
Or through the little window, right. It says right. Pay to the order.
Right, right. It's all deception. It's all a con. You go into any grocery store, you pick up a bag of chips. Feel how much is air in that chip. You got a big, big bag, but you got a half a bag of chips. Is that a deception? Is that a con? Is that a deceit? Is that a lie? I mean, everywhere we look, we can see it, can't we? We're being put on everywhere we go. You know, one lie, one deception, one con, one swindle after another, after another, after another. Right? I mean, we are just swimming in deceit. Isn't it? It's a sad state of affairs, but we are. But this is what the Bible says. He says, you know, verse 16, these are the things which you should do. Speak the truth to one another. Plain and simple. That truly shows where we're at. A person who lies and lies and deceives and lies, believe me, they can't be a saved person. I don't believe it for 1 minute. Because we're told in Proverbs that there are 7 things that God hates, and one of them is a lying tongue. And when you look at the fact that the devil is a liar from the beginning, you see whose father you are. If all you do is lie, everything that comes out of your mouth is a, you know, cockamamie baloney. You know, I mean, this is why I look at some of these selected officials and I say, well, geez, you know, no wonder we're in such a mess. They wouldn't know the truth if it bit them in the rear end. And you get so tired of it. It says that speak the truth to one another. Judge with truth in judgment for peace in your gates. In other words, he says, judge with truth and judgment for peace in your gates. In the gates, basically, it was their courts. That was where they would gather together to have the judges hear people's cases. Okay? Well, they were to speak the truth and make judgments on the basis of truth. Okay? Look at our courts today. Isn't it a joke? I mean, you see what these lawyers are doing? They are getting murderers off scot-free with technicalities and phone. You know, here's the statistic I just heard yesterday from Paul Harvey. The average murderer in this country spends 6 years in prison. Right now, we have 100,000 murderers in prison. We've got 800,000 that have been let out of prison. We've got 800,000 murderers roaming our streets, but that's just the ones who went to prison and now have been out. Okay? That doesn't include all the killers and all the serial murderers that are running loose that have never been caught.
Could have been all right.
Okay? Right?
Yeah, really.
What's that?
Could have gone all night without hearing that.
Oh, well, okay. Okay, well, you know, it's one of these nights, you know, might as well just, you know, keep beating the drum. Beat it to death, all right. Okay. Anyway, this is the world we live in, right? Well, it's talking about here, judge with truth and judgment for peace at your gate. Well, there's no peace in this country because they've made such a mockery, such a joke in our judicial system of what's right and what's wrong. It makes my blood boil. I think it must really anger God when you look at how our courts are just flooded and gutted with all these frivolous nonsense lawsuits to everybody trying to win the lotto on some legal thing. Okay, everybody devouring one another and suing one another with no cause, no justification whatsoever. Okay, this is where we are at. But it's a judgment from God because we have taken judgment, truth and justice, and we have just run it down the toilet. Out of the, you know, because you know, we have no concern for truth. All we want is money or to be right or whatever. And it says in verse 17, also let none of you devise evil in your heart against another. Okay, this is what God requires of us. Don't devise evil in your heart. I mean, if you look at this, the scenario where we're at today, okay, Look in the day of Noah. Jesus said that as it was in the day of Noah, so shall it be in, with the coming of the Son of Man. Well, in the day of Noah, we are told that every imagination of man's heart was continually evil. Okay? Well, he's saying, don't devise evil against your brother in your heart. Well, there's so many ways you can devise evil against other people. Okay? I mean, it's just this whole concept of coveting what another person has or possesses or whatever, and then you try to, you know, steal from. I mean, it's just one small example. I can go on forever and ever and ever. But I was talking about lawsuits. Okay? Look at the number of lawsuits that are going on today when somebody maybe has the slightest little fender bend. And they figure, oh, I got a bad back, I got a bad neck, I got this and I got that. You know, when they can do cartwheels down the street and they know it. Well, what are they doing? They are devising evil against one another, right? They are making up all these cockamamie baloney lies, okay, so they can get a lawsuit against somebody, right? This is going on all over the turf. There's no truth there. That's just one small, tiny example of where people are devising evil in their hearts against other people. No question about it. He says, this falls right in line with it, that verse 17 again. Also, let none of you devise evil in your heart against one another, and do not love perjury. The two go hand in hand, don't they? I mean, perjury is just simply lying, isn't it? Do not love perjury. Look at the O.J. Simpson trial. Isn't it? That, to me, this is a glaring rebuttal, as far as I'm concerned. Or actually, it's kind of like God just rubbing our nose in what we have, what we want, actually. Okay? Isn't it? Because this is what we don't want to hear the truth. Okay? So you hear people just lying on the stand. I don't want to get off on this Marv Albert thing, but you see what's going on in that situation. We're just, he's a sports announcer that, you know, I don't want to get off on some of the stuff he's been doing, but this woman that he's been, you know, seeing for 10 years has now, you know, the old adage, hell has no fury as a woman scorned. Well, I guess this is really taking place with this woman because she felt like, well, he's going to dump me. So now she's dragging him into court and accusing him of abusing her. And, man, she's just ruining this guy. But they had it on tape. The lawyers played the tape the other day about her talking to this taxicab driver saying to him, okay, now here's what you were to say on the stand. You were to tell him that he's wanted you to find a little boy, or he wanted young boys, and the taxicab driver then would say, well, okay, and then you'll give me $50,000 and a new car. And she said, yeah. So she's perjuring herself, right? But she's ruining this guy. And I'm not saying he didn't deserve to be ruined, but I'm just simply saying this is what's going on all over the turf, where people are lying, and they are deceiving, and they are distorting and perverting the truth. You know, right?
They got that on tape?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his lawyer's got it on tape. Okay, let's wind this down. We've got less than 10 minutes. And he says, do not love perjury, for all these are what I hate, declares the Lord. Verse 18. Then the word of the Lord of hosts came to me, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Again, he emphasizes the Lord of hosts. I didn't count the number of times that phrase is used, but it's over and over and over again in this chapter, isn't it? I think, again, it is to emphasize to us that, hey, he's the one that's speaking, okay? And what he says goes. He's the final authority. Okay, there is no one, no thing above him. And so when he says it, you can bank on it. You can take it to the bank, even in spite of your feelings or your experiences. So he says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, verse 19, the fast of the fourth and the fast of the fifth and the fast of the seventh and the fast of the tenth months will become joy, gladness, and cheerful feast for the house of Judah, so love truth and peace. So here's the thing. We were talking about how, like it was the last chapter last week, where people, a delegation from Jerusalem, I mean from Bethel, came down to Jerusalem to talk to Zechariah and the prophets and the priests and to ask them, hey, should we continue to fast in the fifth and the seventh month? The fifth month, when they were in Babylon, they fasted on the fifth month of the year because that was the month that commemorated the time when Nebuchadnezzar came down and destroyed the city of Jerusalem along with the temple. So they commemorated that by fasting all the 70 years they were in captivity. And they also fasted the seventh month because that's when everyone was incarcerated away into Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar left the poorest of the poor. He gave them some land. He says, you can have the land. And then he put a governor over them by the name of Gedaliah, who ended up becoming assassinated in the seventh month. So they fasted for that period of time. But now he mentions two other fasts. He says the fast of the fourth month, the fast of the fifth month, the fast of the seventh month, the fast of the tenth month. So if you look at their history, you'll find that the fourth month was the month that actually the city, if I'm not mistaken, was taken. The fifth month is when it was destroyed along with the temple. The seventh month was the month that they commemorated in, as far as Gedalia was concerned. But the tenth month, that was the month, I guess, was commemorating when the siege of Jerusalem began. And it took several months before the city finally fell. So they came up with all these fast days that they were keeping and to commemorate these different things that had happened. And it was a time of mourning. It was a time of sorrow to commemorate the destruction of their nation, of their people, of their city, of their temple. Well, God said he's going to turn all of this around to become days of feasting and rejoicing, and he's going to turn their sorrow into gladness. But what's interesting to me is, here's the Jews, they came up with all these different fast days. Here, God mentions four of them, okay? But there was many more. By the time Jesus got on the scene, Jesus gave us a parable about this this Pharisee and a publican who went into the temple to pray. And the Pharisee is there saying, oh, I thank thee, God, that I'm not like this clown over here, and I fast twice a week, and I don't do this, and I don't do that, and I tithe, and I... Okay, well, this guy was fasting twice a week. But, of course, he was boasting and bragging about it, and Jesus had made reference to the fact that people of his day would make a habit of of fasting, and they would wear long faces, and they would, he said that these kind of people had their reward because they were only out to get the sympathy of men or to be looked down as being holy and, you know, godly and religious and whatever else. Okay, well, that's how what it disintegrated into. When God, in the Old Testament, he only required one day of fasting, and that was the Day of Atonement. That was in our month of October. That was the day that the high priest would confess the entire sins of the nation, okay, and that was the day that they would bring, the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies and sprinkle the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat, with the blood that God could see. That was one day of the week that God said, you shall afflict your souls. He didn't even say fast that day, but they interpreted that to mean that you shall afflict your souls on that particular day. That was the only fast day that God basically required of them, okay? But they, trying to be religious, trying to make acceptable God, came up with all these different fasts. And one thing about when you begin to, you know, require all these different fasts and all of these different restrictions and legalisms that you begin to put on yourself or your congregation or your people or whatever, that doesn't make you more religious. That doesn't make you more godly. If anything, it makes you proud. It drives you from God. I think that if we just get back to basics and just do what God requires. Now, there's nothing wrong with fasting. I think that fasting is a good thing, and I do it, okay? But I don't tell people I do it. It's just simply, I think it's a good thing to do. But I would never sit here in Bible study and say, well, you know, I think every Thursday we need to fast. Everybody should fast. And if you don't fast, you're sinning and all that baloney. Hey, that's between you and God, right? It's just something that unfortunately men get a hold of and they turn it into some legal, stumbling block. Anyway, let's wind this down. He says basically at the end when he's talking about all these different fast days, he says they would become days of gladness and cheerful feasts of the house of Judah. So love, truth, and peace. He ends that sentence with just, that's what I really require you: love, truth, love, peace. Forget about the fast. And in verse 20 says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, it will yet be that the peoples will come, even the inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants of one will go to another, saying, let us go at once to entreat the favor of the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will also go. So many peoples, many nations will come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem to entreat the favor of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days 10 men from the nations of every language will grasp the garment of a Jew, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. Now, here's an amazing prophecy, isn't it? To me, it's really amazing. First of all, it's talking about the millennial period. He's talking to the remnant of the people of Israel who don't see a future for themselves, for their nation. But he's guaranteeing this. He says, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Now, look who's talking. The Lord of hosts, right? He says, it will yet be that the peoples will come, even the inhabitants of many cities, and he also said many nations will come where? They will stream to Jerusalem to see who? Who does he say? They say, let us go at once to entreat the favor of the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. And I will also go. So many peoples and mighty nations will come to seek the Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts is Jesus Christ. He's going to be in Jerusalem, ruling and reigning, and the nations of the world are going to be streaming into Jerusalem to, you know, have an audience with God Almighty. Is basically what they're saying. And the whole world will recognize at that time that the Jew really has been the chosen race, the chosen people of God. And they will grab hold of ten men will grab hold of one Jew. In other words, ten, I think, is just more of a symbolic number, meaning, you know, a collective number standing for all men. All other men will grab hold of a Jew and say, hey, buddy, hey, you know, come on, put in a good word for me, right? Let's go see the Lord, right? Everything's going to be so changed around. I mean, look at how the Jew is so hated today. They are absolutely hated. About the only group of people who really love the Jews today are born-again Christians, okay? Well, virtually every other group of people despise them in one way, shape, or form or the other, okay? And it's only going to get worse. But the true born-again believer can see the Jews' prominent place in God's plan. And therefore, they recognize them as really being God's chosen people. And certainly, they don't hold them in contempt or despise them the way others do. But it's going to be a day, what? It's going to be a glorious day when all nations are going to be going to see Christ to entreat his favor. And they're going to be a peace and harmony with the Jews, which we don't see today. Look at the terrorist group Hamas and all the other, you know, Arab nations that absolutely hate Israel. The Jews with an infernal malice. They just absolutely hold them in absolute contempt. Well, that's all going to be completely done away with when Christ is ruling or reigning. We read that verse 23 again. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, in those days, 10 men of the nations of every language will grasp the garment of a Jew, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. I mean, what does Emmanuel mean? God is with us, and we've heard that God is with you. So it's going to be Christ is going to be ruling and reigning in Jerusalem, with his people, among his people. So, anybody have anything you want to add or share?